Hi everyone, and thank you very much for joining us on another episode of Lit Publishing's podcast, Lit Radio. My name is Miro, and as always, I will be your host for today's show. With me today, I have a very special guest. It is Mark Pilkington. How are you today, Mark?
I'm very well, thanks, Miro.
It's great to have you on a podcast on a Friday of all days, and we haven't had any snow yet, so that's really good.
It's good news.
Yeah, it is good news. And of course, Mark is the author of Retail Therapy: Why the Retail Industry is Broken and What Can Be Done to Fix It. And of course, for our audience, Mark is an experienced retailer and consultant, and he is based in the UK. He has worked for major retail groups on strategic developments in a rapidly changing sector with clients in Europe, the US, Middle East, and Asia. And we're very happy to have him today talking about the books and a lot of the themes and ideas behind it, because I think in general, we see that there is a problem. And it's often something that we talk about, you know, amongst us, or you hear about it in the news when it comes to the retail sector, but we don't really know why it is happening. And I do believe that this book is the great antidote to figuring out the problems that are currently arising there. But before we get into the book, Mark, I really want to ask you, what actually inspired you to become an author and start writing?
Well, I found myself with some time on my hands at the beginning of 2017, and I was going to look for a job, and my wife said to me, rather than, you know, go out and work 24/7 again and don't see me and don't see my daughter, why don't you do something at home? Why don't you write a book? And I said, well, what would I write a book about? And she said, why don't you write about what you know? And I said, well, I guess I'm an economic historian and also a retailer. Maybe I'll write the history of retailing. To be honest, it didn't really inspire me. I mean, I think everyone Miro's got a book, they say, in them, yeah. But most of them never get published. Anyway, I sat down on the first day with my coffee, switched on my laptop and started looking at what was happening, because I'd been head down as chief executive of a major group with 850 stores. You don't get a lot of time to think, to be honest, you just do. When I started looking at it, the news feed flashed up on my screen, particularly at that time in the States. Retailer after retailer was going bankrupt. And they weren't weak retailers. They weren't the ones that you get from time to time in all eras and decades. You know, a few go under. But this wasn't like that. These were good brands, and there were many of them. I mean, in the US, there were as many as sort of 250 major brands had gone out of business. Wow. And, you know, some very big names. Sears, Kmart, had gone into Chapter 11. American Apparel, Toys R Us, Sports Authority, which is a huge retailer in the US, and many, many others. And I thought, something's going on. But it wasn't just the bankruptcies, it was the closures. In 2017, there were over 8,000 major stores closed, and that's a staggering number. I mean, the previous biggest year was 2008, but of course, we all know what was happening in 2008. Right. It was a great recession. This you understand, but you know, the American economy was barreling along at 3-4%, and despite all of that, 8,000 stores were closed, the most ever in one year, and you know, like, even just the department stores in the US had laid off more than 100,000 people, which is more, by the way, than all the miners and steel workers in the US in just a one-year period. And so we were seeing a lot of damage to the industry. And also, apart from the bankruptcies, we were seeing a lot of major names that had really dominated the retail scene over the last 20, 30 years. Names that I respected enormously, like Victoria's Secrets, Polo Ralph Lauren, Abercrombie & Fitch. These kind of names were not going into receivership, but they were suffering many quarters.
You could see the signs in
there. Yeah, you could see the signs. I mean, they were suffering many quarters of declining sales. So I was just amazed at what was going on. And I started looking then at the malls. And there's a very interesting website in the US called deadmalls.com.
Right.
And they track the sort of decline and ending of American malls. And they've got 450 names on there. And I went through it, you know, I looked at all 450. And there were names that I knew, places I'd lived in the States. Many of them were dead already. And a lot of them were clearly in decline. Because once a mall loses, you know, three or four of its big anchors, and the big department stores like Macy's and JCPenney's, Sears, were closing a lot of outlets.
It was a snowballing effect.
It was a snowballing effect. And, once a mall's lost its big anchors, really, it's on the way down. And there's nothing as ghostly as a half-empty mall. It's the antithesis of, of a great shopping experience. So there's clearly something very wrong. And then I looked at the UK, and it was the same story in the UK. And we've had House Fraser, we've had Mothercare, we've had New Look, we've had Maplin's, HMV's just gone. So there were lots of things happening, and I thought, what is happening to retailing? I mean, I've worked the last 35 years in and around consumer businesses. I've worked in manufacturing, I've worked in retail, retailing proper, I've worked in e-commerce, and I've also done brands. I've done wholesale brands. And so I've worked all over the supply chain, and I've never seen anything like this. And I'm looking at it and thinking, what on earth's going on? And everyone was saying, well, it's the internet. And I think this is the sort of knee-jerk reaction. And it's definitely a big part of it. But I felt there was something more going on, and I wanted to look into that.
Yeah, and that's fascinating. And there's so much in there I want to unpack. Because, and the first thing, actually, is what you finished off there. And that's this idea, this kind of overall reaction. Well, it's the internet. Well, it's the Amazons. It's the, whatever it's popular at the moment when it comes to e-commerce and online shopping. But I definitely think that there's a deeper, more rooted problem. And what really kind of was very shocking for me was just the names that you mentioned there when you were explaining. I mean, these are guys and, brands that have been around for so many years, and they're in all different, sectors, in all different ways of doing business. You know, it's not just, let's say, the tech center. When you talk about Maplin's or maybe more entertainment-focused like HMV, it is literally all kinds of brands are falling into this trap. And it almost makes you think like there's a conspiracy going on. You kind of been sitting there with, post-it notes and like, well, this one's happening and that one's happening. What is the problem? So let's start to kind of unpack this and go into the book itself. And I really want to perhaps go part by part, because the book, it has so many details and so many explanations in there. And I think a bit of an overview on each part will be very important. And the first part is the one that really sticks with you, and that's the retail apocalypse now. So can you perhaps give us an overview of, what is this apocalypse? I mean, you already have, but in your opinion, how did it begin and where does it stand today? Is it still as strong as it ever has been since, that 2008 recession? Or did we perhaps get a bit better and then kind of we're going downhill again? Like, what is the source of this?
Well, I think, obviously, let's start from the recession. It was obviously very bad for retailers, and it took a few years to rebuild. But by the early 2010s, particularly in the United States, retailing was actually going through what looked like a major renaissance. In fact, the period between about 2010 and 2015, we saw the fastest rate of stores building in the US in history, and of mall building as well. So the industry recovered from the 2008 recession and was barreling along at a high pace. It seemed to hit the wall from about mid-2015 onwards. There was definitely a moment at which all of that sort of came to a juddering halt. And I think part of the problem was that it was growing so fast and had taken on a lot of debt in order to grow. Mm. Because one of the factors is that actually a lot of the American retail industry is owned by venture capital companies. And, they were doing what they often do, which is to take on a lot of debt and grow the business very, very rapidly by opening lots of stores, with the hope probably of then being able to, float the business.
Sounds like a great idea to me.
Yes. I mean, I think, they liked retailing because it seemed to be a stable, strong cash flow business. But it was, in retrospect, the wrong strategy to be doing at the time when the technological revolution was gathering pace. And I use the word technological revolution rather than just e-commerce, because I think it's broader than just e-commerce. But it was gathering pace and starting to do serious damage to the retailers. And I think they overextended themselves and then got caught by this rapid growth of e-commerce and other technological developments, and also some other factors on the demand side, which we'll probably come on to, which have started to sort of choke off the ability to buy things of their core younger, because retail is really supported by younger people under the age of 50. If you look at big categories like fashion, beauty, household goods, people setting up houses, children's clothes, children's toys, these kind of things, it's all to do with people coming through in their 20s and 30s and early 40s and sort of setting up families and getting their lives established. And that wasn't really feeding through. So I think there was some demand side problems and some major supply side problems with the technological revolution, and the combination of all these factors really hit the industry hard at a point where it had overextended itself. And that explains the very high degree of damage.
Yeah, absolutely. And let's talk a bit about the consumers, because you mentioned it. So that's such a, in its own way, such a monster when it comes to a discussion and trying to figure out what consumers want. When do they want it? How do they want it? So you mentioned there a lot of younger people, you know, under 50s, establishing families, establishing their life. And of course, they would have the need for all the different products and services that the retailers would offer. Did anything change since that 2015 era when it comes to consumer behavior? Now, you touched upon kind of the explosion of, you know, online shopping, e-commerce and all of that, but that can't be all of it. Surely there's got to be something else in consumers that has changed the way they behave when it comes to, I suppose, interact with brands especially, and brand loyalty seems to be vanishing overnight. And what is the cause for this?
Well, let's look at the two sides very briefly, because I think we've got a demand side problem and we've got a supply side problem.
Right.
And let's take a few steps back and look at, you know, why do we have brands and why do we have shops in the first place? Bit of big picture. Okay, so imagine the scenario. It's 1800. Okay, and you know you're a farmer, working your land, etc. How is your life, and what kind of shops do you have, and what kind of brands do you have? And the answer is not very much, because you're basically a subsistence farmer, which is most of the people in the world, and you make most things for yourself because you really don't have much resources. So you grow your own food, you probably build or repair your own little house or shelter. And you, your wife probably makes some clothes, etc., or maybe you make some clothes. And then there's a few things that you can't make for yourselves that you have to go to local craft shops, essentially, and buy. So you need a new horseshoe for your horse, you go to the smithy. You know, you need a new hammer, you go to the guy who produces hammers. And you go straight to a little production unit, but it's a manual production unit. Now, you're not really buying brands. You know the person because it's in. You don't travel very far. Okay. Now, I know this sounds like, you know, a long way from where we're trying to get to, but just imagine that situation. Now, in that situation, you don't have many shops and you don't have many brands. Then the Industrial Revolution comes along, and suddenly this little job shop is put out of business by massive factories. Mechanized factories that can churn out product in vast quantities. And so you're suddenly you've got access to goods at much, much lower cost, because the cost of production with a large mechanized factory is dramatically lower.
Of course.
Yeah. Now, so you've suddenly got all these goods, but how are you going to get them? Because those goods may be produced, you know, in Sheffield and you live in Bristol or somewhere. So the point is you've got to do a couple of things. And the first thing you've got to do is physically get the goods. Now, that factory wants to produce goods in thousands. It wants to produce exactly the same good thousands of times because it's got big, long setup time. So it doesn't want to chop and change around. Okay, if it wants to give you the best price, it's got to find a way of having mass demand. And you only want one of the things. Okay, so someone has got to gather all the people together to buy the same product. You know, so you have a distribution system, a supply chain, which involves shops, you know, right. Because that's the place where you get it. And the shops basically take the bulk and what is known in the business is break the bulk into smaller pieces and sell them individually. The other thing is, although you knew your local smithy and you trusted him, you don't know this factory. It's a long way away. So how are you going to know if it's good or not? You know, and so what those factories started doing is they started doing something different. They started stamping their name on it, okay? And then they invested in advertising to tell everyone, you know, around the country or whatever, that they had a good product.
This is it. This is the one.
And that's why you have brands, okay? So this is why you have shops, and that's why you have brands. Now, the cost of production is very low, but a couple of things about it. Firstly, in order to get it to you, the factory essentially sells it to the brand. The brand stamps their name on it and triples the price. They have a big sales force and a big advertising budget to cover. they send them out, sell it on to the retailer. The retailer's got big stores and lots of people and lots of costs, so they also triple the price again. So although the manufacturing cost is very low, by the time it gets to you in the store, it's actually 8 times what it costs to produce. That's the first thing.
Right.
Okay. The second thing is the whole system is geared up to feed the factories. It's what you call a push system. Okay. You as the consumer are on the receiving end of this push system. Okay. You're on the receiving end of the goods being pushed at you through the stores, and you're on the receiving end of the advertising that's coming through. Okay. Where do you get your information about the products? From the advertising. Do you have an independent source of information? Not really. Do you have much choice about where you buy? Well, probably not, because in your town there may be 3 stores that are near you that sell this type of product. That's your choice. And so you see the advertising and you obediently go into the store and you buy the product. Right? Do they take your name? Do they do anything with you? Not much. They basically, you receive the product, you go away, they don't know much about you. Okay? They just, it's a push system. They're not trying to respond to your needs and requirements. They may do a little bit of research, and I know I used to do this. They do a bit of segmentation, so they know that you're this demographic, this age or whatever, right. And they've got somebody else who's a different demographic. They may have different products for the two of you because of your different circumstances. But even those segments, I know because I used to do this, we'd make them as big as possible. We weren't trying to service you individually, far from it. We were trying to get you to do what everyone else did. Okay, so it's a push system. And it's an expensive system despite the low manufacturing cost. Okay, but you've got no choice but to pay, right? Because what is your choice? You've got 3 shops and they're probably all selling the same brands anyway. Okay, now, then the technological revolution comes along. And the technological revolution does 2 things. Firstly, it gives you another way of getting your information. And this is why I say it's broader than e-commerce, right? Where do you get your information about products today?
Personally, I always check it online first.
Exactly. And what kind of things do you look at?
Well, that would be other people's user reviews. It would be product reviews. So it could be, you know, audio, usually visual. People actually look a lot, I know, on YouTube when it comes to product reviews and, you know, unboxings and openings and how to do. So in a way, a lot of the stores that would offer advice on how to use things would be, well, there would be no need for them because you can go and you can check it out for yourself.
Exactly. You now have an independent source of information, which is objective. It's not, you know, I mean, the advertising is saying what the producer wants it to say, okay? Now you have the real story. If the product's not good, people like you will have written about it, okay? So in the old days, if someone complained about a product, nobody heard about it, maybe a few friends and family, but that was it. Nowadays, if there's a bad product out there, it'll go viral, and you're never going to touch it. So you've got a great source of information. And the key thing about that information is that rather than having to pay all the brand's advertising costs and all the brand's sales force costs, you can get all that for free. Okay?
Big difference.
Big difference. So that means that whereas 20, 30 years ago, if you wanted to start a new brand or a new product, you had a heck of a time. And most brands failed, new brands failed, because you were going up against this massive brand persona that had been built over many years.
The ad industry was insane.
It was insane. So, you know, you come with, you know, your Joe Schmo with a new product and you're trying to launch it or whatever, no one's going to buy it because they don't trust it, okay? Mm. And you don't have the big advertising budget and all of that and the distribution. Right. Now, if you're an entrepreneur and you launch a new product and it's a great product, it offers great value and it's innovative, it's going to go viral on the net. It's going to go viral through social media. And people are going to hear about it. And so you can actually do all of that as an entrepreneur now without the vast advertising budgets and without the vast sales forces of the brands. And it's coming to the consumer, therefore, potentially at a much lower cost.
Okay. Right.
The second thing is you no longer need the shops with their very expensive large spaces and their big teams of people because you can buy it. And this is where we come to e-commerce, of course. You can buy it directly off the net. Okay. Now, we'll perhaps touch on the cost structure of net businesses. But let's just leave it at the simplest level at the moment, that assuming that you want to buy from this website, that they've already got you recruited or whatever and signed up and you like their product and you like their service, it costs them 10% to get the product to you. That's the cost of shipping, etc.
course.
Okay, now, they've got a low fixed cost because they've got probably a small head office, and they've got a low-cost distribution centre. Now, compare that with a store group, okay? They've got vast costs. I mean, stores costs, are, the actual cost of the stores themselves is about 25 to 35, 40% of sales versus 10%. So you can now get this product at a much lower cost because you're not using those expensive stores to access it, using the internet to access it. So you don't need the brands and you don't need the stores. When you cut those two stages of the supply chain out, it adds up to a massive, massive value gain. And that is the technological revolution providing that. And my view is that that technological revolution is every bit as huge and as disruptive as the original industrial revolution.
Ryan,
yeah.
Wow, there is so much I want to go over because this is absolutely fascinating. And my next sort of point of discussion, and I suppose question, is a bit of a two-part.
Yes.
Because in preparation for this podcast, I was thinking about this a lot because I suppose in a way that you did, I also had kind of that feeling in the back of my mind thinking, but why? You know, there's got to be, you know, there's a lot of reasons for this. And you've given us such a great detailed explanation for this. So the first part of my question would be, is that certain brands and certain, you know, companies and distributors are able to adapt to all this. They understand it. They know how to fit in and where their place is. But others don't. And we see it with the huge range of different industries that are impacted by this and all these different brands in there. So my question is, are they out of touch? Why are they not adapting to this? What is it you know, what has happened? Because you see one big name, you know, you see your House of Frasers and Toys R Us, and you would think that there would be notice, you know, you would be put on notice and, you know, these companies will start realizing, okay, this isn't a one-off thing. This is not a crazy coincidence. This is something which is actively happening in our industries. But they all, you know, seem to be going on and then it keeps happening. Why is this?
Well, there are a few brands and retailers who are bucking the trend, and we'll perhaps come on to some of those a bit later on and see what they're doing differently. But you're right, the vast majority of the retail industry has not, you know, reacted particularly well to this threat. You know, I was around, I had an e-commerce business in 1999. And at that time, we thought we were all going to destroy the retail industry back then. And of course, it didn't happen. And the internet was very clunky and slow in those days. But there was a dot-com crash, of course, where a lot of people went bankrupt. Now, the retailers, I think, looked at that and thought, aha, okay, this thing isn't as bad as we thought.
Problem solved.
Problem solved, yeah. So they thought, you know, problem solved, not as bad as we thought it was going to be. And in any case, you know, we can also do our own websites and we'll keep our retail business and we'll also do the website as well and we'll have both. And that's what they did. But the problem was that although they were building their web businesses, they didn't build them anything like as fast as the pure play internet companies, particularly obviously companies like Amazon. And therefore, we now have a situation where, for example, in America, Amazon controls about 44% of the American e-commerce market, and the top five or six big department store groups have only got 7% between them.
That is crazy.
So if you think back in 1997, you know, when Amazon was still in a garage somewhere and these guys ruled the roost, they've now, they still rule the roost in the retail bit, but now the retail bit is only 80%. Of the total market. And this new sector, e-commerce, has exploded from nothing up to nearly, in some countries, nearly 20% or 25% in some cases. So you've got a classic case where you've got actually a sort of static or declining channel with some big dominant players, and you've got an exploding new channel, which has got a few companies that really dominate it. And the legacy old companies are not really present in this new channel. And the problem with retailing is that it's a very high fixed cost business. You don't have to lose all of your business or anything remotely near to it to have a lot of problems in retailing. All you have to do is lose the top slice. Most retailers make around between 5 to 10% net profit, which means you've only got to lose between 10, say your margins are 50%, just for simplicity, you've only got to lose between 10 and 20% of your sales and you're not profitable. Not the whole lot, just 10 or 20%. And, you know, retailing is, you know, because it's a big, heavy, fixed cost industry, it just is very, very vulnerable to that loss of top slice of sales. And that's what's happened. They've lost that top slice, and now a lot of them are basically headed towards bankruptcy.
That is absolutely fascinating. I had no idea it was in that margin of 5 to 10%. And so this leads into the second part of my question, because I have a bit of I suppose a case study of myself and something that I've experienced when it comes to, I suppose, the way that this could be solved. So stop me if you think that I am mistaken, because this is purely out of my own experience and I don't have any data to back this up. And of course, for our listeners, I would include it if I had it and I put it in the description, but I don't. So this is just purely me talking. Is that I've had the great privilege to travel a lot, and one of the places that I've gone, you know, to quite a lot of times was actually Japan, and that was one of the few places where I was actually fascinated by how strong retail actually is, and how it is part of the overall country's culture. Not only it being very sort of a cash focused society, but in general, retail seemed to be where people go. And the online retailers and the e-commerce retailers had nothing close to the technology that's used by places like Amazon and a lot of the strong e-commerce Western channels. But the difference for me was the experience upon being in that retail environment, which was very different to what we would experience in a high street or a shop, any type of retailer. And it was very tailored towards going in a shop and coming out of it, you know, with value, not only a product, but a value, you know, having enjoyed the experience, having gained something from it, having been more engaged with the brand or what they're offering there, you know, being very serviced very thoroughly, absolutely amazing customer service. And that really stuck out for me because it was unlike anything I've ever seen. And it seems to be working. So I suppose that the second part of my question would be, what is the overall solution of this? What can brands do to get back in the game and kind of, you know, get back into that kind of 5 to 10% and, well, expand even beyond and, you know, tackle this problem?
Well, I think you've actually hit the nail on the head, which is, and I believe strongly in the future of stores, but they have to change.
Yes.
Because I think that stores need to really understand what their role is. Or retailers need to understand what is the role of their stores. And if you look, again, big picture stuff, if you look at what stores are actually for or what stores actually do, they have two roles. The first role is what I'll call the product fulfillment role, which is back to how we get the products from the factories to the consumers. And their second role is customer service and marketing to create a great brand environment, dynamic, with fantastic consultancy level of customer service, where they want to sit you down and really understand your needs, and they know a lot, and they can help you.
Yes.
Now, the problem is that really, over the last 20 or 30 years, the first role, the product fulfillment role, has really eaten up the second role. If you look 20 or 30 years ago, retailing was actually a reasonably good career for people, and people used to spend long periods of their lives and stay in the same departments. So you'd go in to the fashion department, and you'd actually get someone who knew all the brands and could really help you. You know, if you went into the underwear department, if you're a woman, you know, the women in the underwear department were fitting consultants. They could really fit you and get you into the right, you know, a bra or whatever for you. You know, if you went into the makeup store, the people really knew how to sell you makeup, etc. Because it was a reasonable career, it was reasonably well paid, and it had pensions and all these kind of things. Now, over the last 30 years, what's happened in retailing, as the pressure's gone on the retailers, as rents have risen, which is a major problem throughout this story, property is having a huge impact on everything.
Yes.
But as the rents have risen, and as the demands, you know, with the new owners, the demands for dividends and profits have risen. The one thing that's got squeezed is the job, is the staff job. And these days, if you work in retail, it's part of the gig economy. A lot of people have zero-hour contracts, which means they don't have any guaranteed earnings. They're at their beck and call of their employers. They don't have proper pensions. And it's become a very difficult job. And, you know, the stores have got bigger and bigger. They're paying higher and higher rents. They're full of stock. The stock processing itself is backbreakingly hard, particularly in industries where the product's a bit heavier. or where it changes a lot, like fashion. I mean, I've worked in stores a lot, and any day I spend in the store leaves me with enormous respect at the end, because I'm exhausted having spent about 10 or 12 hours, you know, in a store. So it's become a backbreakingly hard job. All the stock processing is, you know, you've got to book it in, you've got to price it, you've got to steam it. If it's fashion, you've got to put it out on the peg or on the shelf. You've got to move it around for different marketing campaigns. You've got to do all the markdowns for regular sales. You've got to count it for audit purposes. You know, there's so much stock basic processing that is really hard work. So the combination of low wages, low benefits, and very hard work has meant inevitably that it's a very high turnover industry. It's not really a proper career
a transition,
anymore.
If anything.
It's a transitional. People are working to go somewhere else, you know. And so the level of service, and they've also cut, let's face it, the numbers of people. As they've come under pressure, they've cut the number of bods in the store. So, you know, the level of service in reality, and it's not the people's fault, the level of service has basically declined enormously. So the marketing service side of most stores is actually extremely poor in Western countries. Now, the fulfillment side of the goods is now, as we kind of discussed earlier on, happening more efficiently and at lower cost online, you know, because it hasn't got to go from the manufacturer to the brand into the retailer central warehouse and then fired out to all these stores, which are basically other warehouses, and you know, all the stages in that chain are very expensive and cumbersome. It's just really going almost straight from the factory to the consumer, what we call direct to consumer, which means that it's a much more efficient fulfillment model, you know. So the fulfillment side of stores is sort of obsolete in my view. I know that sounds a bit controversial, but I've done a lot of work on this, and you know, there are a lot of stores now who are and these direct-to-consumer brands have opened what they call showrooms, where the product never touches the store. They'll have product in the store to demo the product, but the actual, you know, purchasable stock never hits the store. In other words, you go into the store and you order in the store, but it's shipped directly to your home. That's a very different model. So the fulfillment side of retailing is in great difficulties and it's under pressure. But all of that stock and all that space and all that cost that is involved with those big glorified warehouses, which we also know as shops, is crowding out the little bit where the stores still have an advantage, which could be the customer service bit, the second role. But it's not there, you see, because they're investing so much in the stock fulfillment side where they're really uncompetitive with the internet. They're losing the one bit where they could be competitive, which is the marketing and customer service side. And as you say, in Japan, where they get that right, they're still doing good business. So the key point really, and we get to the to one of the major themes of the book, is that retailers have got to change what they see shops as being for.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, I mean, why on earth, when you can have a website which is very cheap to put millions of products on, you could put a huge choice of products on, we've seen you can ship it to people more cheaply, you know, why would you use these expensive spaces in the centre of towns and in malls and have huge spaces just to do the bit that the internet can't do, which is the customer service bit? You don't need all of that, okay? And if retailers understood this and switched the fulfillment side to their own e-commerce platforms, so that, you know, the store, you buy in the store but fulfill through the e-commerce channel, the stores could be what they really should be, which is fantastic consultancy, beautiful, you know, offering great consultancy, beautiful spaces with fantastic technology. They could be a lot smaller and less costly, because you don't need this glorified warehouse space.
Yeah, you know? And you know, this reminds me, I had and actually, before we go on to that, my next sort of, I suppose, point of discussion would be, you know, companies that have done this right, good case studies. And one that really stuck out for me, and going back to this, is last week I had the great privilege, actually, to go to a pre-opening event at the new IKEA shop in Greenwich. And my girlfriend managed to get tickets for that from a friend who works there. And it was an absolutely amazing experience. So I was late, I was going there after work, and only had about maybe 20 to 25 minutes to explore this huge space. I mean, it was enormous what they've done there. And it was absolutely fascinating, because the methodology and the philosophy of the entire place followed exactly what you just described to us. It was very much focused on giving you the right experience, making sure that your needs are fulfilled, but at the same time get the marketing across, give you all of the different, you know, variety of products. You could order it there, have it delivered to your house if you could. It had all these different messages going on there, and everyone loved it. It was an absolutely fascinating experience, and I know many people that will go to IKEA just to chill out and have a good time, which is quite interesting in its own way. So can you perhaps give us an example or a case study that, you know, you've worked on or you've come across where this is kind of employed and it does work, and, you know, retailers should really get this message into their heads if they want to stay ahead?
Yeah, well, there's a company called Bonobos in the United States. Have you come across that?
No,
not
necessarily.
It's a menswear brand, and it started as a direct consumer brand. So it was just purely on the net, and they were doing what I talked about, cutting out all the stages of the supply chain, providing a very high quality, very high spec product straight from the top Italian mills, but at a much more accessible price than the big brands. And that was how they grew, and they became very successful. And they got acquired by Walmart. And they have stores, they call them showrooms, or guide shops, I think they call them, but it's the concept of showrooming. And what they do is they have their collections, but they only have one of everything, okay? So they don't have all the backup stock. And they're not focused on stock processing at all. They're focusing on getting the customer in, and customers make appointments. They get them in, they'll give them a beer, they'll give them a coffee, they'll sit them down on nice comfortable sofas. There's lots of magazines and things around. People can hang out there. It's a cool kind of funky environment. They've got great fitting rooms. And they've got guides who are very different from your standard store staff. They're much higher level. They're paid much better. And they're more like out of work actors and actresses. You know, they're really charismatic people, very, very cool, trendy people who are going to take you through, you know, what Bonobos has, and also but understand your needs. And the idea is that they want to create the relationship right from the first moment. So rather than what we experience in retail, which is, you know, very crowded, you can't find anyone there, you know, you go through rack after rack and then they're out of stock and the fitting rooms are crowded and, you know, not very nice, etc. If you can even find a staff to help you, and they say, you know, you can only take two items into the fitting room, yeah. They're very like the police, aren't they? What you've got there is a beautiful experience. And they'll spend an hour with you, go through everything, they'll explain the fabrics, the cuts, everything. And it's very interactive. When you've decided what you want, they sign you up into their internet business.
Yeah.
Right, so they'll help you put all your details in, just as if you were doing it on the web, and then you're in their internet environment immediately, and they ship the product same day if you live in major cities to your home for free.
Wow.
Yeah, and people really appreciate the customer service, obviously, and they also really appreciate being able to walk out hands free, because, you know, there's nothing worse than having to schlep around with lots of heavy shopping bags. So it's a very cool experience, very nice experience, and the product shows up, you know, a few hours later in the home, and you know, the process is complete. So that is a great model, and they're doing extremely well with it. And that, in a sense, is what's influenced, I think, some of the big players like IKEA. Nordstrom's in the US, which is a very progressive department store group, has also started opening, because the standard Nordstrom's is like 20,000 square foot. It's enormous. And it's they're starting to open much smaller Nordstrom's called Nordstrom's Local, which really are just like service centres. So they've got coffee bars in them. They've got, I think, sort of salons, because their main customers are women. So they've got things for women like nail bars and salons. They've got a lot of free stuff. I think the coffee and buns and things are actually free. And again, they've got lots of terminals and computers. They've got lots of high-level staff. And what they're saying is, you know, they've got some products, but not the full range by any means.
Right,
and they've got these beautiful screens, and they sit people down. They say, well, what is it, you know, what are you interested in? And then, they, you know, this person takes you through it. And, well, we've got this, etc. And they show it all like that. And they do fitting, and they'll have, like, one of every size of their core fit products. And so they establish the customer's size and all that sort of stuff. And then, as just like with Bonobos, they're transacting online direct to the consumer. Now, by doing that, those store groups are focusing on the bit where they can have a competitive advantage over the pure internet players because of this high level of customer service in this pleasant environment. But that's a world away from what you have in most retailers with the sort of serried ranks of all the products laid out, you see, in a very confusing way. And also, a lot of it's out of stock. I mean, if you look at the reality, I've worked in retailing for nearly 10 years. You're out of stock a lot of the time. A lot of transactions never complete because of out of stocks, because it's very difficult to keep in stock in hundreds of stores. You may have a lot of stock in the business, but is it in the right store? And the answer is that the best sellers sell out in the big stores almost immediately, and then it's the devil's job to try and get the stock moved. Meanwhile, the stock is sitting in the small stores, not selling, and has to be marked down at the end of the season. That's a very inefficient model. So one thing you get away from when you move to the centralized stock and shipping direct to the home is you don't have all that problem. If you've got stock in the business, you can fulfill, you know. So the level of out of stocks is much, much lower in these internet businesses. And that, you know, as a customer experience, it's got to be better, you know. So these guys are innovators, and they are succeeding. There are other people who are innovators using in similar way, but they use the space even more as a community center. I don't know if you have heard of a company called Rafa Cycling.
I have heard passively on social media networks, but I haven't used them myself.
Well, they're basically a community of very passionate cyclists. It was started by cyclists, for cyclists. The team are all cyclists. And basically, they see their stores as clubhouses. So they've got product, but they've also got great coffee bars. And if you sign up, there's like an annual fee, which is not very much. You get a lot of stuff. You get special deals. You get unique products. You get on the trips because they do trips, and you get free access to the trips, the buses and everything like that to take you to the trips. Lots of information and basically social life. And you also critically get the coffee in the coffee bar and some of the food, I think, for free. So people just, the keen cyclists, just go and hang out there.
Yeah, that's a good deal.
It's a great deal. And what they do, you see, is the staff and the customers are the same. They're all keen cyclists. So they talk. They chat about product, like a conversation. And they get ideas from people. People say, well, if you change, this is great, I tried it, but, you know, if you did this. So they get constant feedback. It's a very interactive process. So the stores are like the what we call a third place, which is the meeting ground between the home and work. That's the concept of a third place. It's a place where you hang out. Starbucks was the original kind of third place. You know, I'll see you at Starbucks. You know, I'll be working in Starbucks on my computer. You know, it's a place you go and hang. And that's what Rafa's done. It's got all the cyclists hanging out in their stores. And it's amazingly successful. It was just bought by the Walton family, the owners of Walmart, for a very considerable sum, I think £200 million pounds. So it's a fantastically successful business because it's using its stores for something unique, which is to be like a community. And people still want that. See, I don't believe the future lies in all of us sitting at home on our mobile phones and never seeing each other, never rubbing shoulders. That's not the future. That's not what we're social animals. We love to hang out in a cool environment, or a warm environment, you know, that's also cool. But, you know, you've got to use these spaces for that unique, to create that unique source. Because if you try and just be another version of the internet, which is just like serried ranks of products, prices, and you're trying to be the internet, but in a store, you're going to lose. Because the internet can do all of that much better and much cheaper than you.
Yeah, and much quicker.
And much quicker, absolutely. And everything.
Yeah, and what a powerful message in there. And to close up, Mark, I want to ask you the question I ask everyone that actually comes on the podcast, and that is, what are you currently reading? Or do you perhaps have any recommendations for our listeners?
Well, at the moment, I'm reading, you know, a lot of books about retailing, obviously, in the future, right. And articles. I mean, there's just a barrage of information when you're, because I'm tracking it worldwide. I've covered all the countries in my book. So I'm trying to track what's happening in retailing in, you know, 7-8 major markets. And I also do, you know, podcasts and blogging and things like that. So it's a lot of work, and I do consulting. So I wouldn't say that I'm reading the works of Shakespeare at the moment, to be honest. I read a lot online. I've tried to if you like, assemble all the information out there about retailing and brands and put it all in one place, which is, you know, trying to put all this in the book was the main thing. Mm-hmm, was I was mm-hmm. I tried to, as I thought of it, I'll write the book of the apocalypse, you know, I'll put it all in there so people in, hopefully it's a, people say it's a very quick read, you know, that, you know, in a few hours or maybe a couple of days, you can get complete brain dump of everything that's happening in consumer markets. It's not just shops, I mean, it's affecting real estate agencies, it's affecting banks, it's anyone who's got space, it's affecting car dealerships, anyone who's got space on the high street or in malls or, yep. you know, physical presence, it's affecting them because all of these industries are going through the same kind of transformation and there's huge disruption in all of them. So I was trying to put it all in one place so that people, whether it's governments, because governments are messing it up too, which is another subject, whether it's investors or whether it's people who work in the industry or whether it's just people who care about the brands that they buy, could get it all in one quick hit, basically.
Yeah, absolutely fascinating stuff. And on that note, I'd like to thank you very much for joining us today on the podcast, Mark. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you.
Well, Miro, it's been great. Thank you very much for inviting me. Well,
thank you. And of course, for our listeners, if you enjoyed our conversation today, I would urge you to please check out the links in the description below where you can find out everything about retail therapy, why the retail industry is broken, and what can be done to fix it. And you can always reach out to us on social media and let us know what you think about today's podcast. It's always great to hear from our audience on each episode. And there will be links so you can see what Mark is up to and check him out as well. And of course, we will be very much looking forward to see you next week on the podcast. And hopefully we won't be under 10 feet of snow until then. So we'll see you next week.